Osho, Tao, the Three Treasures, Volume 2, Talks on Fragments from Lao Tzu's Tao Te Ching, given at the Osho Commune International, Pune, India. Discourse number 8.
The first question. As I have heard from you, the whole existence is the answer, not the question. So when the answer exists, not the question, why does the question come from the answer? It is not coming from the answer. It is coming from you, and coming from you because you have not seen the answer yet. You have not heard the answer yet. To know existence, to be existential, you live in the thoughts. You live in the past, in the future, but never here and now. And existence is right now here. You are not here. Hence the question arises. The question arises because of not meeting with the existence. You think you live, but you don't live. You think you love, but you don't love. You only think about love. You think about life. You think about existence. But that very thing is the question. That thinking is a barrier. Drop all thoughts and see. You will not find a single question there. Only the answer exists. That's why I insist again and again that the search is not really for the answer. The search is not really so that your questions can be answered. No. The search is only how to drop the questions. How to see life and existence with a non-questioning mind. That is the meaning of Shraddha, trust. This is the deepest dimension of Shraddha, or trust. You look at existence with not a questioning mind. You simply look. You have no idea how to look at it. You don't impose any form on it. You don't have any prejudice. You simply look with naked eyes, absolutely uncovered with any thoughts, any philosophies, any religions. With eyes like a small child, you look at existence, and then suddenly there is only the answer. There are no questions in existence. Questions come from you. And they will go on coming. And you can go on accumulating as many answers as you like. Those answers won't help. Until you attain to the answer. And to attain to the answer, you have to drop all questioning. When there is no question in the mind, the vision is clear. You have a clarity of perception. The doors of perception are clean, open. Everything becomes suddenly transparent. You can go to the very depth. Wherever you look, your look penetrates to the deepest core. And there suddenly you find yourself. You find yourself everywhere. you will find in the rock, if you look deep, deep enough, then the looker, the observer becomes the observed. The seer becomes the seen. The knower becomes the known. If you look deep enough in a rock, in a tree, or in a man, or in a woman, you go on looking deeply. That look is a circle. It starts from you, passes through the other, comes back to you. Everything is so transparent, nothing hinders. The ray goes, becomes a circle, falls back on you. Hence, one of the greatest secret sentences of the Upanishads, Tattva Masi Svetketu, thou art that. Are that art thou. The circle is complete. Now the devotee is one with God. Now the seeker is one with the sought. Now the inquirer himself becomes the answer. In existence, there is no question. I have lived in it long enough now, and I don't come across a single question, not even a fragment of a question. One simply lives it, and then life has a beauty of its own. No doubt arises in the mind. No suspicion surrounds you. No question exists within your being. You are undivided, whole. The second question, Lhasa and you keep on saying, just be ordinary. However, you seem to be so extraordinary, your appearance, your lifestyle. Is there a lot of difference between a master and an ordinary enlightened person? There is none. And whatsoever looks you extraordinary, it is because you don't understand what ordinariness is. Because you have never lived ordinariness. Ordinariness itself has become extraordinary to you. What do you see is extraordinary in me? I live one of the most ordinary lives. When hungry, I eat. When sleepy, I sleep. I don't practice anything. I even don't do anything. Whatsoever happens, happens. I move with it, float with the river. But to you, it can look extraordinary. Because you don't know the taste of ordinariness. Once you know the taste, then you will understand. Everybody is after being extraordinary. Because that is the search of the ego, to be someone in special, to be someone unique. Incomparable. And this is the paradox, that the more you try to be exceptional, the more ordinary you look, because everybody is after extraordinariness. It is such an ordinary desire. But if you become ordinary, the very search to be ordinary is extraordinary. Because rarely somebody wants to be just nobody. Rarely somebody wants just to be a hollow, empty space. This is really extraordinary in a way, because nobody wants it. And when you become ordinary, you become extraordinary. And of course, suddenly you discover that without searching, you have become unique. In fact, everybody is unique. If you can stop even for a single moment your constant running after goals, you will realize you are unique. It is nothing something to be discovered. It is already there. It is already the case. To be is to be unique. There is no other way of being. Every leaf in a tree is unique. Every pebble on the shore is unique. There is no other way of being. You cannot find a similar pebble anywhere on the whole of earth. Two similar things does not exist at all. So there is no need to be somebody. You just be yourself and suddenly you are unique, incomparable. And that's why I said this is the paradox. Those who search fail, and those who don't bother suddenly attain. But don't get confused in words. Let me repeat. The desire to be extraordinary is very ordinary, because everybody has it. The understanding to be ordinary is very extraordinary, because rarely a Buddha, a Lao Tse, a Jesus has it. To try to be unique is in everybody's mind. And these all people fail, and fail utterly. Because how you can be more unique than you are already? Uniqueness is already there. You have to discover it. You are not to invent it. It is hidden within you. You have to expose it to existence. That's all. This uniqueness is not to be cultivated. It is your treasure. You have been carrying it forever and ever. It is your very being, your very core of being. You have just to close your eyes and look at yourself. You have just to stop for a while and rest and look. But you are running so fast, in such great speed. To achieve it, you will miss it. It is said, one of Lao Tse's great disciples, Li Peju, says it, that once an idiot was searching for fire with a candle in his hand. Says Li Tazu, had he known what fire is, he could have cooked his rice sooner. But he remained hungry the whole night, because he was searching for fire and he couldn't find, and he had a candle in his hand, because how can you search in the dark without a candle? You are searching uniqueness and you have it in your hand. If you understand, you can cook your rice sooner. I have cooked my rice and I know. You are unnecessarily hungry. The rice is there, the candle is there, the candle is fire. There is no need to take the candle and search. If you take the candle in the hand and go on searching all over the world, you will not find fire because you don't understand what fire is. Otherwise, you could have understood. The candle was just in front of you. You were carrying it in your hand. It happens sometimes. People who use glasses, it happens that they have the glasses on and they are searching for them. And they may be in a hurry. When they are in a hurry, they search everywhere. And they completely forgot that the glasses were on the eyes. One can get in a panic. You may have come certain experiences like this in your life. Because of the very search, you become so panicky and so worried and so disturbed that your vision is no more clear. And something which is just in front of you, you cannot see it. And this is the case. You need not search for uniqueness. You are unique already. And there is no way to make a thing more unique. The word more unique is absurd. Unique is enough. There exists nothing like more unique. It is just like the word circle. Circles exist. There exists nothing like a thing more circular. That is absurd. Circle is always perfect. More is not needed. There are not degrees of circularity. A circle is circle. Less and more are useless. Uniqueness is uniqueness. Less and more doesn't apply to it. You are already unique. But this one realizes only when one is ready to become ordinary. This is the paradox. But if you understand, there is no problem in it. The paradox is there and beautiful. And no problem exists in it. A paradox is not a problem. It looks like a problem if you don't understand. If you understand, it is beautiful, a mystery. Become ordinary and you will become extraordinary. And try to become extraordinary and you will remain ordinary. Third question. After 2 years with you, I seem to have become an idiot. I don't know where I am going or what I want or even what I like. I find this state very painful. And in all this suffering, I feel that I am growing apart from rather than closer to you. This is precisely what I want. You should become idiots. That is the greatest performance you can perform. That is the peak, the pinnacle that intelligence can achieve. This is the whole effort, that you should be ignorant. You should drop all knowledge, all belief. All rubbish that comes from accumulating words, theories, doctrines, they give you a sense of power and a sense that you are somebody and a sense of intelligence. When you stop carrying this burden of scriptures, doctrines, doctrinaires, suddenly you realize that you are an idiot. Because now the ego is no more on firm grounds, trembling. In fact, the earth, I'm trying to take it away from your feet. The moment will come when you will realize that you are an idiot, and this is a beautiful moment if you understand. You can miss it. There is more possibility to miss it. Then you can fall back again on your knowledge and cling to it. If you understand it, immediately there is a transformation. Because ignorance means a cleaning. Now your slate is clean, nothing is written on it. Now your mind is empty, hollow, nothing fills it. Now there is no furniture in the mind. Now the house has its space, and much is possible in this space. But the moment you call it idiotic, or you call yourself that I am feeling like an idiot, you have already condemned it. Soon we will come across losses saying that in this whole world only I am an idiot. Everybody seems to be so wise. Everybody knows where one is going, from where one is coming. Only I seem to be bewildered. Everybody seems to be so intelligent. Only I seem to be muddled-headed. Soon we will come across that say. So try to understand this state. This state is a great passage. From the rubbish that you call knowledge, now you are entering the world of being and existence. In the interval, the interim period, you will feel like an idiot. Feel and enjoy it. Don't get disturbed. What is wrong in being an idiot? Ego suffers. That's why you feel pain. I don't know where I am going or what I want or even what I like. Beautiful. That means there is nowhere to go. You can only be here and now. The goal has disappeared. Now you don't feel certain where are you going. Perfectly beautiful. When the goal disappears, you cannot go anywhere. You can be only here. And here now is the goal. But you feel this state very painful because the ego has to die. The ego would like to be a knowledgeable person, not ignorant. The ego would like to cling with mere words, without any content in them. But still it gives you a feeling that you know something and you know where are you going. You will feel painful if you are persuaded by the ego. If you are not persuaded by the ego, you will feel happy and you will celebrate. You will be happy that you have attained something worth. Don't create suffering for yourself. Try to look at this ignorance from a totally different vision. That is what I am trying to impart to you, the vision to look at things in a totally different way. Ignorance is clean, cleaner than any knowledge. Ignorance is silent, silent than any knowledge. Knowledge is always noisy. Knowledge is a marketplace. Ignorance is a cave somewhere deep in the Himalayas. Knowledge is ill. Ignorance is healthy. Knowledge is ill because of the ego. Ego is the greatest disease, and you cannot feed ego if you don't cling to knowledge. If you cling, you can feel you are somebody, you know something, you are not an ignorant person. You can compare yourself to others that you know more. Everybody else is ignorant, is stupid. You are very intelligent. You have degrees from the universities. You exhibit them in your sitting room. You frame them. You bring it to everybody's notice that you are no ordinary person. You are very cultured and cultivated, knowledgeable. Everywhere you go on sowing your knowledge, wherever you can get a chance, even a slight chance, you jump in and you start sowing your knowledge, your software. You start arguing. You start proving yourself right. The whole effort is egoistic. Ignorance is healthy. Ignorance is innocent. Innocent like a child, a newly born babe. Ignorance is never cunning. Knowledge is always cunning. You call it cleverness when you have knowledge. When somebody else has it, you call it cunningness. But cleverness and cunningness are the same. Knowledge can deceive others. It is a criminal. Ignorance cannot deceive anybody. At the most, it can be deceived by everybody else. Ignorance is never a crime. Knowledge is active, aggressive, male. Ignorance is inactive, passive, female. Ignorance is receptive, a womb. Knowledge is never receptive, it is always rejecting. Have you seen people who are knowledgeable? It is very difficult from them to bring a yes. It is very easy to bring a no. No is always ready on their lips. Because no gives them the power, the feeling of power, that they can argue, they can destroy. Knowledge does not know how to say yes. And misses much, misses all, because the existence is known only by one who has given a total yes to it, signed a blank check, and given it to existence. Only in that trust, mysteries are revealed. You become intimate. Ignorance is wonderful. So be an idiot and be totally. Don't hesitate. And there will be then no pain, no suffering. The suffering and pain is not coming from ignorance. It is coming from the dying ego. And the second part of question is also very, very important to be understood. I find this state very painful. And in all this suffering, I feel that I am growing apart from rather than closer to you. Yes, that happens. Because when you come for the first time near to me, it is through the ego that you are close. Because you don't know anything else. You come as an ego. The closeness is false. Because how the ego can be close? It can only pretend that it is close, but it can never be close. How the ego can be intimate? It is always in conflict. It can only deceive. But it cannot truly be intimate in close. Because closeness means the ego should disappear. Only then you can come close. If you are surrounded by the ego, armored in it, how can you come close to me? Impossible. But the ego gives you a feeling that you are coming close. That too becomes a food for the ego, that now you are close to Bhagavan. Now you are close to your master. There is always comparison in it, closer than others. It is not really closeness. It is the old game of the ego. It continues around me. People go on thinking, who is more closer? People are even worried, who is going to be my successor? What foolishness. I am here, you cannot be intimate to me, and you are worried who is going to be my successor. People who are worried about it must be deep down unconsciously hankering that they should be my successors. They are trying to pose that they are closest. But a closeness needs no certificates, and a closeness needs no justification. It simply is there in its total naked beauty. There is no need for it to claim. When you come first, for the first time near me, it is the ego that comes nearer and gives you the sense of nearness. And when the ego stops dropping, disappearing, dissolving, suddenly you see for the first time the reality that how far you are from me. But don't be worried. Closeness through the ego is no closeness. And even a great distance with no ego is closeness. Let the ego die. And then you will understand the real closeness. A real closeness is not a comparison. You simply feel exactly with me to be me, not even near. But let the ego die completely. It is still alive, maybe on the deathbed, but not dead yet. And don't give it an oxygen cylinder. And don't feel pity for it. Let it die. Help it to die. Because that is your disease. Even if it is painful, let it be. Because no rebirth is possible without pain. If it is suffering, rejoice that the moment of suffering has come for you. Because only through suffering one reaches to the blessing, to the benediction. I often get the feeling that you don't care about us, not in the way I have known caring in the past. How does a Buddha care? You will have to become a Buddha. Otherwise, there is no knowing about it. A Buddha cares in such a totally different way. His care is not a worry. When you care about somebody, you worry about him. A Buddha cannot worry. That has to be remembered. When you care about somebody, you are tense, anxious. in anxiety. A Buddha cannot be anxious. So a Buddha cannot care in your ways. When Buddha cares, and it is wrong to say that he cares, because he is care. He is caring. It is not good to say that he cares, because that gives the feeling that sometimes he does not care. No, care is not an act for a Buddha. It is his being. It is his whole way. He is a caring. When he is a caring, it is natural to him that he cares and loves. It does not create any tension and anxiety in him. It creates tension and anxiety in you because it is not natural to you. That point has to be understood. It is something unnatural. When you love, when you care, it is something unnatural for you. Hate seems to be easier, natural. Anger seems to be more easy than compassion. Not to care seems to be natural and easy than to care for you. So whenever you care, it creates a tension. It is an unnatural thing. You are pretending to be a Buddha. That pretension creates the tension. And your caring becomes poisonous. If you care with tension and anxiety, your anxiety and tension will enter into your care also. And you will force the other knowingly, unknowingly, directly, indirectly, to feel obliged to you. You have done a great work. You have been a martyr. You will brag about it. And you would like the other to feel and so and say that he is very, very much obliged to you. This is an ego game. And remember, if this is the way you care, the other may show that he is obliged, but deep down he will never forgive you, never. He will never forgive you, and you cared, and you loved, and you were so helpful, and you served him, and he will never forgive you. In fact, someday, if opportunity arises, he would like to take the revenge. Because it was not pure care. It was poisonous. Your love has something of hate always in it. Your sympathy has something of antagonism in it. Your care has something in it of indifference. It is difficult for you to understand how a Buddha cares. Not in your way, not at all. If that is the only care you know, then a Buddha does not care. But I tell you, he cares. And he cares so much that it is no more an activity. It is his being. It is just like a fragrance of a flower. In fact, if you are not there and a Buddha is sitting alone, then too he is caring. It is just like breathing. It is not that he cares for you. He cares. And that is the problem. Because you would like that he cares for you, then the ego is fulfilled. If he simply cares, and cares for everybody, and caring is his nature, he cares about a rock and about a tree and about you also, So you are not something special. And the ego is always hankering to be special. If that hankering is there, you will not be able to see the caring of a Buddha. For him, existence is one. For him, individualities have dissolved. You don't exist as islands. A whole continent of consciousness exists. You are just parts. He cares. But he is not caring particularly for someone. Even sometimes it may seem that he cares for someone in particular. That again will be a false attitude on your part. It happens sometimes. The person who is more receptive of his care receives more, but not that he cares more. The person who is more open to his caring and love receives more. The person who is closed does not receive at all. And the person who is closed will throw the responsibility on the Buddha. He will say that he is caring for A more and not caring for me at all. Because you never see your own closedness. A Buddha is like an open invitation. He does not address his invitation to anybody. It is an open invitation for all. For everybody. He is like a river flowing. Anybody who is thirsty can come and share. But the river cannot jump into your mouth. You will have to bend down, fill your hands with the water, and it can satisfy you. It can quench your thirst. Of course, it will depend on you how much water you can take from the river. And river is not giving to anybody more or less. River is simply a giving, a sharing. If you are closed, antagonistic to the river, doubtful, skeptical, you stand on the bank. You don't bend, you don't relax, you don't surrender to the river. You go on standing there. You will remain thirsty. Those who are ready to surrender, their thirst will be quenched. So it depends on you. When I say Buddha cares for everybody, because in fact for him nobody exists. Only one consciousness, one oceanic consciousness. But still few people are benefited more. Few are benefited less. Few are not benefited at all. And that is because of you, not because of a Buddha. But you will be able to understand the whole phenomena when something, a ray of Buddhahood enters in your being. Then only you will be able to understand the language. The whole phenomena is so qualitatively different from all that you know, that all the words that we use somehow are not enough. Fifth question. I often get the feeling that your hands are speaking to us and they are saying something different from your words. Are you pointing at the moon? You have caught me right and red-handed. try to understand that. Not only by my hands, by my every gesture I am saying something, if you can decipher it and decode it. When I am saying something. When I am not saying anything, then too I am saying something. When my hands are moving, I am saying something. When they are not moving, then too I am saying something. You will need to be more and more alert so you can listen to me as a totality. Sixth question, when you look at us, what exactly do you see? This question is from Pratima. I see the first layer, the Pratima, which is not real, the pretension, the effort to show something that is not there. Then the second layer, I see another Pratima, which is there, but the first layer is trying to hide it, to suppress it, to push it into the dark. And then I see the third layer, which is so unconscious that the first two layers are completely oblivious of it. The first layer is consciousness. The second layer is subconsciousness. The third layer is unconsciousness. You are not aware of it. Sometimes the third layer comes into your dreams and talks to you and tries to convey some messages, which in the morning either you forget completely, or you remember fragments which mean nothing, or you go to a Freud or a Jung or an Adler for interpretation, which is going to be false because nobody else can interpret your unconscious. It is the individual script. They can have generalized ideas about it, but they won't be of much help. And that's why every psychologist, every psychoanalyst has his own way of decoding it. And they all are right, and nobody can be proved wrong. Only you can decipher it really. It is your unconscious talking to you. It is as individual as your thumbprints. Nobody else can do that work for you. Interpreters are not needed. More awareness is needed. More mindfulness is needed. And then I see the innermost core, the deepest place where no Pratima exists, the emptiness, the being as non-being. When I see into you, I see all these things. And you are also to become alert and to see all these things. Become alert of the first Pratima. The word Pratima is beautiful. It means image. Become aware of the first image, which is a false, a facet, a sewing piece for the outer world, a sew window. You know it, it is not true. Become aware. I am not saying to drop it immediately. Because untruths can be dropped only when you have become mature enough to drop them. Otherwise, they are needed. I'm not saying to drop them abruptly. You cannot, and if you do, that will be suicidal. Let it be there, but you become aware and alert that this is false. When you are talking to somebody, just see when your face becomes false. When you are smiling and there is no smile within. When you are showing that you are attentively listening and you are completely unlistening. When you show that you are sympathetic, but not even a flicker of sympathy passes through your being. Be aware of this first layer. This is all that people know about each other. Then the second layer, which you are suppressing, continuously forcing, and it wants to come up. It is part of you. And more truer than the first. The first is social. The second is natural. More authentic than the first. I am not saying allow it complete freedom. You will go mad. Or you will become a criminal. You will be caught and imprisoned. First become aware about it. When you become mature enough, you can give it by and by a little more freedom. And that freedom will not lead you to anarchy. Then by and by, when you have become aware of the first two layers, your consciousness will be enough intense to penetrate the third layer, the unconscious. To penetrate the third layer is very difficult. Because it consists of your whole past lives. Millions of past lives you have lived. You lived like a rock, then dissolved and became a plant. You lived like a tree and then died and became an animal. And you lived like animals and died and became a man. And millions of lives. Hindus say that 840 million in all, everybody has passed. The third layer consists of all these lives, the whole cumulative effect, all the sanskaras, all the conditionings, all the karmas. When you have dealt with the first two layers and you have become aware, and not only aware but master of them, now they are no more masters of you but servants. As servants they are beautiful, they have much utility. As masters they are dangerous. Then your consciousness can penetrate the third layer. Third is the real struggle. And without passing the third, passing through it, one can never reach to the innermost core, which you are in reality. But I see all the four layers within you. That's why sometimes I call you fools. When I am talking to your first layer, sometimes I call you Buddhas. When I am talking to your fourth layer, which is not a layer really, but your ground of being. Seventh question. You said a cat is as aware as a Buddha. But why is a cat not willing to give a discourse every morning like you? Cats are always willing. But you have to be ready to be mice. Cats can speak only to mouse, become rats, and cats will deliver discourses. They always deliver. But the whole point is of your being receptive at that level. Trees are speaking, become a tree and you understand. Birds are speaking, become a bird and you understand. And you cannot understand me if you don't become a Buddha. I am delivering the discourse, but don't be deceived by it. Don't think that you are understanding it also. I am talking too, that is certain. But are you hearing me? That is not so certain. You appear to listen to me, but that's more or less appearance. Rarely sometimes I talk for 1.5 hours, rarely sometimes for a single second or 2 seconds or 3 seconds. You listen. Then again you are fast asleep, the words go on falling on your ears. You appear to be listening. And listening is of no use if you are not understanding. Listening is not listening if you are not understanding it. If you are not transformed through it, what is the point of listening? The tape recorder goes on listening to me and recording better than you can record. But the tape recorder is not going to become a Buddha. Just by listening to me, you are not going to become Buddhas. Listening should penetrate. It should be so total that when you are listening, you are completely dissolved into it. Then every word goes to your very core, hits you deep down, penetrates you, and understanding arises through that penetration. It is not verbal. The last question. Here are some of Werner Erhard's sutras from his Book of Lies. Could you comment on one or more of these? The sutras are beautiful. The first sutra, the truth does not mean anything. It just is. It is like a flower. It does not mean anything. What does a flower mean? It just is. Meaning is something of the mind. Meaning is something imposed by the mind. Truth is not something of the mind. When the mind is no more, truth is. So how the truth can mean anything? It just is. If you experience it, it is the truth. The same thing believed is a lie. Yes, absolutely true. If you experience it, only then it is truth. Because truth is an experiencing. It is not believing. Because belief means you don't know. You have a borrowed knowledge. You know something about it, but not it. And something about it is something very far away. It is a lie. All things said about truth are lies. Only truth is true. And the truth cannot be said, it can only be experienced. So what masters go on doing? They lead you from one lie to another, which is nearer to the truth. Then they lead you from that lie to another lie, which is again nearer to the truth. But all lies are lies. Nearer or not nearer does not make any difference. When you take jump from all the lies, that is from the mind, the liars, when you take jump out of the mind, the truth is, it simply is. And only then it is truth. What Jesus says was true for him, but for Christians, all those beautiful sentences are dead lies. Something to be believed in. Just by believing, you cannot attain to truth. If you experience it, it is the truth. The same thing believed is a lie. Obviously, the truth is what is so. Not so obviously, it is also so what. I will repeat it so you can follow. Obviously, the truth is what is so. Nothing can be said about truth, only this much, that it is so. It cannot be compared. There can be no analogy for it. You cannot say it is like this. Truth is only like truth. But that will be a tautology. To say that truth is truth will be a tautology. Because it doesn't add anything more to your knowledge. But this is the fact. Truth is a tautology. Because there is nothing in existence which can become an analogy for it. We cannot say truth is like that. Because only truth is. No other exists. Obviously the truth is what is so. So remember that. Truth is truth. God is God. Love is love. If you ask for definitions, these are not definitions, because a definition means you say something which can become an analogy. But what can be said about love? What can be said about truth? What can be said about God? And whatsoever you say will become a tautology. You don't say anything new, you simply repeat, God is God. So what is the point in repeating? The person who does not know God and asks, what is God? You say, God is God. How he is helped? He will think you a fool. But this is what all the great scriptures have been doing. Nothing else can be done. Everybody is helpless there. All language, all logic falls short. Obviously, the truth is what is so. Not so obviously, it is also so what. If it is obvious, it is okay. If it is not so obvious, then too it is okay. Because both is truth. When you attain to truth, when you experience it, much becomes obvious, and much is not so obvious. Nobody attains to truth completely, can never attain to truth completely. It is such a vast ocean. I will tell you one small anecdote. It is about the Sufi master Jalaluddin Rumi. He was coming from his college where he used to teach his disciples on a horse riding. He was coming back to his home. His disciples were following him on the road. He must have been a very loved master. And then suddenly came there a fakir who stopped the horse and asked a question. The question was, the fakir said, "I have heard that you have become awakened. I have traveled long to ask you one question. What do you think? Hazrat Muhammad, the founder of Islam, is great, or the great Sufi mystic Al-Hillaz? Al-Hillaz has been killed, murdered by Muslims because he was thought to be an iconoclast, and he was thought to be rebellious, and he was thought to be sacrilegious because he asserted an al-haq, I am the truth." Mountain said that this is too much of egoism to say that I am the truth. Had he been in India, we would have worshipped him like Tirthankara Ari Buddha. But in Mohammedan countries, he was murdered. And he is the greatest Sufi. And to ask Rumi, who is a Sufi himself and follows the same path as Al-Hillaz, the fakir was really creating a trouble. Rumi asked the fakir, "Why do you ask?" The fakir said that Muhammad had said, and these are his almost last words on this planet Earth. Before dying, he said, "My God, I could not know you as you deserve to be known. I fall too short." The fakir said, "This is Muhammad's last verdict, that he could not know God totally. And he himself says and himself bears witness that I fall too short." And then there is Hallaz, Al-Hallaz, who said that when I saw God, I became him, he became me. We dissolved into each other. I have known him totally. I have seen him totally. I have become him totally. So who is great? That's why I ask. Jalaluddin Rumi answered such a beautiful answer. Nobody would have ever suspected even. He said, "Hazrat Muhammad is greater than Al-Hillaz." The fakirs could not believe it. He said, "Why? Why do you say this?" Answered Rumi, "Because Muhammad's thirst was so much that he came to know God, came to know him more and more and more and more, but his thirst was so much that it could not be quenched. Al-Hillaz's thirst must have been not so much. Just a drop of God completely satisfied him. That's why I say Hazrat Muhammad is greater." If you ask me, I will also say that those who have known him will always know that something still remains to be known. God never becomes totally known. His very quality is unknowability. You touch him, you feel him, you become him, but still his unknowable mystery surrounds you. Everything never becomes obvious. Much remains which is not obvious at all. It is also so what? Happiness is a function of accepting what is beautiful. Happiness is a function of accepting what is. If you accept what is, there is no possibility of your being unhappy. As I have been observing thousands of people, seekers, non-seekers, this worldly, that worldly, I come across every day the phenomena that I don't see that people are really interested in being happy. Nobody seems to be interested in being happy. Because they are ready to sacrifice happiness for any nonsense, for jealousy, for possessiveness, for anger, for hate, for any nonsense they are ready to sacrifice happiness, but they are not ready to sacrifice anger, possessiveness, jealousy for happiness. So how can I say that people are interested in being happy? They are interested in being unhappy. Whatsoever they say, that is not the point. But I see them continuously trying to be unhappy, trying and finding ways and means how to be unhappy. And really, this is such a tremendous phenomena that in a world where unhappiness doesn't exist, man has created so much unhappiness. He has really proved a creator. Where no possibility of unhappiness exists, how you create? You are simply wonderful. You are past masters in creating unhappiness. You are very creative, but only you create hell. Happiness is a simple phenomenon. Nothing is needed to do it. One just needs to be there and be happy. Happiness is a function of accepting what is. If you don't accept what is, you will be unhappy. And you go on saying that I want to be happy, and you go on rejecting. How can you be happy? Just accept and then see from where unhappiness can arise. You may wait for life and unhappiness will not arise because you have cut it from the very root. But you want happiness also on your conditions and on your terms. In fact, you are not interested in happiness. Otherwise, why should you put conditions and terms? You will say, howsoever one can be happy, I am ready to be happy because I want to be happy. But you say, no, my conditions must be fulfilled. And you put such impossible conditions, they cannot be fulfilled. You have a lover, a beloved. You can be happy right now, but you have conditions. That the lover should promise that forever and forever he should love you. Why bring this in? And how anybody can promise? Because nobody knows future. Your lover is not a god. How can he promise? Even gods cannot promise. Because promise means that the future is settled right now. And future is not settled. It goes on moving in infinite ways. So either the person should say something which is impossible, and he says that I promise, and you also know that this is false. He is deceiving. You know, because you are also a human being, and you also know you yourself cannot promise for the future. You are asking something impossible. In the very asking of it, you are destroying happiness. And if he promises, then too you know that this promise is false. Because how this promise can be given? First you ask. If it is not given, you are unhappy. If it is given, then you are unhappy because this man is lying. And then you will be in search continuously how to prove that you have deceived, your promise was false. As I watch you more and more, the more and more the fact becomes a reality that nobody seems to be interested in being happy. For any nonsense thing, you are ready to lose happiness. You can sacrifice for any rubbish idea. And you never sacrifice anything for happiness. The mathematics is so simple. Happiness is a function of accepting what is. Love is a function of communication. Love is a function of communication. What is communication? Communication is a dialogue where two persons are in deep sympathy with each other. Where two persons are trying to understand what the other is and what the other means. But if you see lovers, husbands and wives and others, you will find them continuously fighting, never communicating. And they say they are in love. And they cannot understand a single thing within them cannot pass without misunderstanding. The husband says something, the wife immediately understands something else. And the husband goes on saying that I don't mean. But then she will not listen, because whatsoever she understands is your real meaning. She will go on proving that this is your real meaning. And the same is true with the husband. Whatsoever the wife says, he immediately interprets it in such a way. He says something else. And this goes on, and this you call communication. This is not communication, this is avoiding communication. It is a conflict. Communication is really when two persons authentically try to understand each other. It need not be always verbal. If it is always verbal, it will be superficial. Sometimes two persons sit in silence or holding hands, just doing nothing. Just meeting and merging in silence. Then communication becomes communion. Then it is being to being. So this is the situation. A discussion, a debate, a conflict is between head to head. A communication is between heart to heart. A communion is between being to being. Communion is silent. Communication is poetic. Discussion is logical. Logic is the most superfluous and superficial thing in the world. Deeper you go, you find poetry, sympathy, heart-to-heart feeling, every effort to understand the other. With the head, there is every effort to misunderstand the other. The whole energy is put for misunderstanding. With the being, all words stop. Only silence flows between two beings. Love is a function of communication. Health is a function of participation. The more you participate with existence, the more healthy you will be. The more you remain standing on the bank, uncommitted, non-participating, just a spectator, the more unhealthy you will be. To be healthy is to be whole, to be with the whole, to participate. Health is a function of participation. Self-expression is a function of responsibility. Ordinarily, people misunderstand self-expression for ego expression. Ego expression is irresponsible. Self-expression is responsible. Self-expression is responsible for the whole, because you understand you are part of it, you participate in it. Whatsoever you do, the whole will be affected. The ego never worries about the other or the whole. The ego thinks that I am an island. My whole concern is centered within me. I exist for myself, and the whole also has to be forced to exist for myself. Ego is irresponsible. Self-expression is responsible, because you participate, you feel. And whatsoever you do, you always feel how it will fit with the whole, how it will affect the whole. Will it bring a benediction, or will it become a curse? It is easier to ride a horse in the direction he is going. Perfectly true. That is the way of let go. Move with the river. It is easier to ride a horse in the direction he is going. You need not even learn riding. The riding and the learning is needed when you want the horse to move somewhere else where he doesn't want to go. Once Mullah Nasruddin was going on his donkey somewhere fast. He passed a marketplace. People asked Nasruddin, "So fast, where are you going?" He said, "Ask the donkey." Because I have learned that it is futile to fight. If I want to go somewhere else, he resists. But he is a donkey, can be forgiven. I am an understanding man. If he cannot go on my way, I can go on his. Ask the donkey. That is what all the wise ones have said, ask the donkey. And let the donkey go wherever the donkey is going. You simply move. Your body is the donkey, the horse. Ask the body and float with it, and you will reach. Don't fight with the body. The body is just symbolic. The world is your body. Don't fight with it. Float, not even swimming, because that too is a subtle fight. Just flowing with the river. Life is a rip-off when you expect to get what you want. Life works when you choose what you get. Actually, what you got is what you choose. So move on. Choose it. Life is a rip-off when you expect to get what you want. You create problems. When you start expecting, wanting, desiring, that means now you are not moving with the horse. You have your own goal. You have your own private game to play. You are not moving with the whole. Then there is trouble. Then there is disease. Then there is neurosis. Then all sorts of anguish arises in you. Life works when you choose what you get. It works when you like whatsoever you get. Just a small difference, it seems, on the surface, but tremendous difference. Whatsoever you have got, liked, accept it, enjoy it, rejoice in it, then life works beautifully. It functions with such a beautiful humming. Actually, what you got is what you choose. So move on, choose it. If you know the secret mechanism of life, whatsoever you have got, you have chosen someday, somewhere, sometime in the past. So now don't fight with it. Move on, choose it, like it. If you can like that you have got, there is no trouble, no problem, no anxiety arises. Things are so easy and so simple. All problems disappear. If you are not all right the way you are, it takes a lot of effort to get better. Realize you are all right the way you are, and you will get better naturally. If you are not all right the way you are, it takes a lot of effort to get better. No, I will not agree with that. Even with a lot of effort, you will not get better. There I disagree. Even with a lot of effort, you will not get better. Realize you are all right the way you are, and you will get better naturally. That is the only way to get better. The only change that is possible is to accept whatsoever you are, wheresoever you are. Through acceptance is revolution, not through effort. Because try to understand it. Who will make the effort? You will make the effort, and you are not right. So the effort is going to be made by wrong men. How can the effort be right? You will be in a greater mess through it. A man is violent and he wants to be non-violent. Who will make the effort? The violent man will make the effort to become non-violent. Then in the very effort there will be violence. You are sexual and you would like to become a brahmachari, a celibate. Who will make the effort? You who are sexual. The very energy which is sexual will make the effort to become celibate. Your celibacy will be a perverted sexuality, nothing else. Accept. Accept your sexuality, don't fight with it. Rejoice in it. Enjoy it. Participate in it. It is part of life. You have to live through it. Don't be wiser than the whole. You cannot be. If the whole has given you sexuality, it means something. Enjoy it. Don't complain. And one day you will find, through rejoicing in it, understanding ripes. You go beyond it. Only acceptance gives you understanding. If you reject a certain thing, you cannot understand it, because already you have become the enemy. How can you understand the enemy? When you rejoice a thing, you are friendly, sympathetic. Understanding is possible. So here I disagree. If you are not all right the way you are, it takes a lot of effort to get better. No. Even a lot of effort will not help. It will mess you more. Realize you are all right the way you are, and you will get better naturally. Life is a game. In order to have a game, something has to be more important than something else. If what already is more important, then what is not, the game is over. So life is a game in which what is not is more important than what is. Let the good times roll. Life is a game. Don't be serious about it. If you get serious, you miss the point. Hindus have always called it a leela, a play, not even a game. Hindus call it not even a game, but a play. Because the game is when a play has become serious. Children's play, grown-ups' game. Children simply play with no result in the mind, with no effort to win it. The very play is beautiful. It is end in itself. It is not a means to something else. Life is a game. Accept it, and soon you will find it has become a play. And when life is a play, it stops. You have understood the whole point. You have become a grown-up. Then there is no coming back. In order to have a game, something has to be more important than something else. A game needs rules. A game needs comparisons. A game needs somebody has to be defeated in it. Somebody has to be victorious in it. If what already is more important than what is not, the game is over. If you accept yourself and enjoy yourself and you become so celebrating that nothing can be better than this, the game is over. Because then for what to play the game? That's why Hindus say those who know, they don't come back. Because to come back is to come back into the game. A Buddha doesn't come back. Because for what? The game is over. So life is a game in which what is not is more important than what is. That's why you always hanker for that which is not. If you have it, it becomes meaningless immediately. You are moving again for something which you have not. Life is a game. The game exists through the desire for that which is not. If you have already that, the game is finished. Let the good times roll. This is it. When a game becomes a play and good times are allowed to roll, this is it. There are no hidden meanings. In fact, there are no meanings. Hidden are not hidden. Meaning is a futile, meaningless word. It is mind creation. Don't ask what meaning life has. It has none. Don't ask what meaning existence has. It has none. It is a purposeless play. There are no hidden meanings. All that mystical stuff is just what so. A master is one who found out. Perfectly true. There are no hidden meanings. You become enlightened when you have found it, that there are no meanings in life. In fact, when you have found it, that there is nothing to be achieved, you have become enlightened. When you have come to realize that there is nowhere to go, you have arrived. A master is one who found out. A master is not one who has achieved anything. A master is one who has found out that there is nothing to achieve. It will be very, very difficult for you. because you are all achievers. Even if you are here with me, you are to achieve something, some spiritual nonsense. And I'm here to by and by seduce you to become a non-achiever, because then you are enlightened. If you could really accept what were not okay, that you were not okay, you could stop proving you were okay. If you could really accept that you were not okay, you could stop proving you were okay. If you could stop proving that you were okay, you would get that it was okay not to be okay. If you could get that it was okay not to be okay, you could get that you were okay the way you are. You are okay, get it? Enough for today.